Oh, yeah, it's the download here on WGN Radio. The show goes to 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk about the philosophy around voting. Heard so many different people say now with Trump and Clinton, you know, I'm just going to sit this election out. We'll talk with our resident philosopher about how voting came to be, why voting's important. And not just sort of like, you know, that civil thing where we're like, or civic thing where we're, oh, you got to go, you have to vote. Just a little bit more to understand why we vote. So we'll talk with Professor Al Genie coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And we'll also talk about fantasy sports. Regulations are winding their way through the Illinois House. Sites like FanDuel and DraftKings will soon have license and taxes and everything else. But what happens to the smaller businesses that run fantasy leagues? Are they going to be taxed out of the game? We'll find out about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Joining me tonight, now, at the big table, is a frequent guest here on the download, but we've never had him here in Chicago. Rich Cohen has a new book out called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. It's a story of a young Rich Cohen who was once assigned by Rolling Stone magazine to follow the Stones and write about them. He learned much more about the band than just the music. It's a great story about what makes a band like this tick and if the band is actually that anymore. Cohen was such a part of the experience that Jagger recruited him to work and write with Martin Scorsese on the HBO series Vinyl, which just wrapped up their first season. Rich is a local product, and he's authored several books, including Monsters, the story of the 85 Bears, and he works for all sorts of publications like Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and, of course, Rolling Stone. Rich Cohen, welcome to the download. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great... I kind of want to start the story chronologically and talk about Honky Tonk Woman. And talk about your experience. There's a great passage in this book about, you know, sort of sneaking up to your older brother's room.
Well, I'm like, you know, the typical little brother. Everything's from the point of view of a little brother. And I grew up in Glencoe, and I have a brother 5 years older than me. And at a certain age, he moved up to the attic, which is like he moved to the frontier. You know, there's no law. He could do whatever he wanted up there. And he had this incredible stereo, and I was not allowed up to his room ever. And I was sitting in my room, and I heard, and all my records were like, I don't know. The best record I had was Rhinestone Cowboy. They were nuts. Hardcore records. Right. And I heard the intro to that song, Honky Tonk Woman. It kind of lifted me out of my bedroom and carried me into his room and up the stairs. And I feel like it kind of called me into a new life. It completely changed my life. And I became like a Rolling Stones fanatic very early. And unbelievably, you know, people say that this book is like almost famous.
Yeah.
And it kind of is. You know, I talked to Cameron Crowe about it after I wrote it. But it's kind of like this is the Rolling Stones. And this isn't just, I don't know, what almost famous. This is the greatest rock and roll band in history. And in chronological time, very soon after I first heard that song, went off to college, I came out of college and I came to New York and I got a job at Rolling Stone. A lot of stuff happened. But very early on when I was 25.
Yeah.
I got a call from my editor, said, what are you doing this summer? I said, I don't know, what's going on? He said, can you go to Toronto and sort of hang out with the Rolling Stones? I'm like, okay.
Yeah, sure.
No problem.
Like today, now. Yeah. Well, what I loved about it, setting that up, was a passage in the book that, you know, when you sat down with the editor, people who worked at the magazine told you, you know, if he asks you who your favorite band is, don't tell him for real because he'll never assign you to
right.
cover that band.
Well, this, so you, this was Jan Wenner, who's sort of a figure in his own right, who started Rolling Stone. I was working at a little newspaper, and I remember I got a call. Jan wants to meet you. Can you come in for a meeting right now? I'm like, oh, God, look, I'm dressed like garbage, man. And I remember I had a shirt that didn't have buttons on, and my friend took my sleeve and stapled my sleeve shut. And I walked over to his office, and my editor came in. He said, listen, Jan's going to ask you who you want to write about more than anyone in the world. Don't tell him the truth, because whatever you tell him, he'll never give you that assignment. So I wanted to write about the Rolling Stones. So he said, who do you want to write about? I said, I want to write Bob Dylan. He said, that's great.
That's great.
And that's the only assignment I never got at Rolling
Stones. Never, never. We'll give you something secondary, the Rolling Stones. All right, so let's catch back up. So in Toronto, you show up. What I love about, and I kind of tease this out when talking to Ro and Anna at the crosstalk for the shows, is, you know, you'd think, okay, you get to Toronto and you're going to have a night's sleep and then you're going to catch up and there's going to be a traditional sort of itinerary that's given to you. But it's very rock and roll in the way that they're like, are you ready? You just landed? Great. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Let's go.
Right. Well, the first thing to say is I went to Central School in Glencoe, and I had a gym teacher named Don Kreitzer who used to make you do like 15 push-ups for being a smart ass and run laps and everything. So I got the thing to run to go up to Toronto, and I get to my hotel, which is a Harbor Castle hotel where Keith Richards had been busted for heroin not very long before. And I asked him, how can you be back here? He said, if I didn't go wherever they had busted me, I couldn't go to any city in the world, basically. And I unpack and getting ready to go to sleep. It's like 10 o'clock at night, and Keith's manager comes over and says, let's go see him. I said, what? He said, they're rehearsing right now. Let's go see him. And these guys, to me, seemingly were like 50 years old. They were like older than I am now, but they rehearsed from like about midnight until 7 in the morning. And they took me in a car over to a junior high school, basically, in the outskirts of Toronto, totally deserted, nothing scarier than a deserted, you know, junior high school, and into the gym, which is like, I'm looking for Mr. Kreitzer. It's like I'm back in the gym. And what's going on in the gym would drive Mr. Kreitzer insane. The Rolling Stones have set up their stuff, and they're playing the loudest rock and roll you've ever heard. And you can hear it echoing through all the – and all I can think about is the kids, man. The kids who are away for the summer have no idea what's going on in
their idea
school.
That these guys are up there figuring out their set lists. They're rehearsing. I mean, they're on stage. All the guys are talking to each other. They're trying to figure out what song should we play next. And the only people in the room are the engineer and you.
Right, and the Rolling Stones. And what's kind of cool about it was what they would do is – they would start talking and someone would yell out a song like, let's try Memory Motel. You know, let's try When the Whip Comes Down. And the engineer would actually get the CD out and play it. And they would listen to it and play over it. And Ron Wood is writing down the chords because some of these aren't even his songs.
Right.
And they play it through again over the CD, and then they play it on their own and they give it like two or three times. And if it's good and they like it, then they write it on a board and they go on. And one of the coolest things I saw that always gave me an idea about how the Rolling Stones work, which is Keith Richards drives the rhythm of that band, is they played, I forgot what song it was, but they start and they're playing and Charlie Watts, the drummer, is 200 yards away making himself tea.
He starts up there and then it's like whenever they want to join in,
they're so comfortable with each other. Yeah, and just sort of sits down.
It's their office day job. I mean, they've done this for so long. They rehearse how they want to. It's a shorthand.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for you to be in that room, I mean, and this is really getting at the idea of thinking about your brother's room upstairs and then being in this, on the outskirts of town, this junior high school in Toronto. With you and the Rolling Stones. I mean, was it hard not to have an out-of-body experience?
Yeah, and actually, that's where the title comes from, which is I was interviewing Keith Richards, who's like sitting in this chair, a big velvet chair, like in a leopard skin robe, and he's got a doctor's bag he's carrying with him everywhere. And he looks and he goes, tell me what ails you, because in here I got a cure for everything, you know? and at one point, I'm asking him questions, and he's sort of, and I'm nervous, and I'm 26. And by the way my questions are going, he's confused. He goes, wait a second, what year were you born? I go, 1968, which now doesn't make me so young, but then did. And he just started to laugh. And he goes, you know what? I should be asking you questions. You tell me. I have no idea what it's like for you. There's always been the sun and the moon and the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Rich Cohen, the book is The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Let's take a quick break, come back. You know, one of the things that came out of this book, which was fascinating for me, was the relationship between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. I mean, we talk so much in our pop culture world about Lennon and McCartney and the duos and how bands sort of surround themselves around the two egos in a band. Well, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were no different. We'll talk more about that with Rich Cohen when we return here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, author Rich Cohen. He's back in Chicago. He's the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, talking about his unbelievable assignment and a boyhood fan of the Rolling Stones. And he got a chance at an early age writing for Rolling Stone magazine to follow the band. And this really chronicles not only that story, but the history. I mean, you get into a lot of different interviews with people that surrounded the band members, about the history. And you say it in the book. I mean, this isn't the first biography of or historical account of the Rolling Stones. There are hundreds.
Yeah, no.
Why go about putting together a definitive historical account of this band?
Well, I feel like when there's a lot of books about one thing, it's often because it's never really been gotten. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when you really get something, the books kind of stop for a while. And the reason is because the Rolling Stones, most of the really good books about him were written by guys who are kind of their contemporaries, their age, who were often writers for Rolling Stone in the middle of the real craziness, right in the middle of it. And they had no perspective to get the good, the big picture. And maybe it's because of my age, but I kind of felt like this music, and not just the Rolling Stones, but rock and roll was so important to me. Waiting for records, it kind of gave my life a kind of meaning. It was a kind of religion for me when I was a kid. And I felt like it kind of died.
Yeah.
It died while I was working at Rolling Stone. You felt it die.
This would be like the late 90s.
Yeah, I felt when Kurt Cobain was killed himself, that was kind of it. That was kind of it, in a way. And for that kind of vitality, and probably the computer and the MP3 and all these different things. And I felt like rock and roll, that kind of rock and roll had died, and nobody had stepped back and written the story. And I felt like I could write the story, man. I could write the big story of rock and roll, what it meant, what it mm-hmm. felt like, why it was so important. And I can use the Rolling Stones as the way to tell that story because they're the greatest rock and roll band. They're the only one that survived. They're right. the only one still playing. And they're guys I actually happen to have worked with and know and have all this experience with.
What I love about the book, too, is it's not just this glowing, love letter to the Rolling Stones. I mean, you're critical of the band. You count the band now, the band that has been in the current last couple decades, seems to be phoning it in, or it's more commerce than it is rock and roll, that they changed somewhere along the line. And, you know, this is not about the love of the music. This is about business.
Right. Well, sort of when you write a book like this, you have to decide, like, who's your loyalty to? Is your loyalty to the band, or is your loyalty to the reader and the truth? And if it's to the latter, it has a chance to be a better book, and it might piss some people off. And probably the more people it pisses off, maybe the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, you know, the Rolling Stones, it's sort of like they, at a certain moment, they were at the avant-garde, and they were the cutting edge, and they lost that. And the question, and that's not that, they had a stretch of four records where they were the best ever. Maybe the best four records in a row ever, the greatest rock band ever. And it's not unusual that you can't keep up that pace. No one's ever done it. And if you look at great artists, they probably, most of them will have a stretch like that. And that's sort of typical. But the question is, why did they fall apart? What was the last great record? Did they break up? And for me, who was kind of in some ways a lonely kid, you know, with a lot of friends but still kind of lonely, it's sort of like the Rolling Stones were like a gang. And what was so great about them is you felt like you could be in this gang, man. You could be part of this thing. And for me personally, I get into the gang and I get into the room and the two leaders of the gang hate each other. It's completely depressing.
Let's talk about, I mean, that's the root of maybe the current or modern day troubles of the Rolling Stone was the relationship between lead singer Mick Jagger and guitarist Keith Richards. You know, being there and seeing them, you kind of categorize them in a fun way, where Richards is the passion and Jagger is the show. How would you say it?
Well, they're like the prototypical rock band. So Jagger, Richards literally is like the rhythm, and he plays the rhythm guitar, he sets the rhythm of the songs, and he kind of creates the floor in the world. And Jagger is like the, you know, the kind of dancing ray of light moving all around the stage. He is literally the front man. He is in front. He stands for the band. He's the voice of the band. He's hugely important. That's a big thing, which is when they went off on their own, they're less apart than they are together. They are a great, great rock band.
Well, why don't we start with what makes them work? You know, we'll talk about what doesn't, why they hate each other. But what made Mick Jagger and Keith Richards work when they were at the height of the Rolling Stones?
Well, they're, you know, they met when they were kids, when they were little kids. They knew each other when they were 6 years old. And they both fell in love with this kind of music, which was Chicago music. It was Chess Records. Jagger was sending away to Marshall Chess, who was growing up in Glencoe and working at Ricky's Delicatessen, and his part-time job filling out orders from Michael Jagger from Dartford, England, and sending him records, okay? And then Jagger has these records on at the train station in Dartford and runs into Keith Richards, and he says, what are those? And they're Chuck Berry records and Muddy Water records. And they get together and they start playing these records. And just because they're not Chuck Berry and they're not Muddy Waters, they change the songs as they attempt to copy them, creating something new. They kind of mess them up with their own personality. And then they come back to Chicago and they kind of bring Chicago's music back to Chicago. I always say the longest road from the south side of Chicago to the north side went through England, you know, because that's how this music wound up. And they really started out as collectors. And they met Brian Jones. There was a little club in England called the Ealing Club, which was open just for this kind of music. Jagger and Richards went in one night and they saw this blonde-haired guy playing slide guitar. It was Brian Jones. They were completely blown away. They started this band, originally called Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys, then became the Rolling Stones, then became the Rolling Stones. And they were just the greatest bar band you've ever seen in your life. And that kind of was their ultimate. When people, I knew a lot of people who saw them then, 1962, 1963, in the basement clubs in London, jammed in with kids their age, just playing Little Red Rooster or I Just Want to Make Love to You or whatever the song was. And the energy of that kind of drove their entire careers. And that's what made them. It was the yin and the yang of those two guys playing with each other and playing against each
other. As they got bigger and obviously took off, I mean, there was a struggle with the with them about who the leader of the band was. I mean, there was always, when Jagger went into solo work, you know, Keith Richards was critical, you know, like there was same the other way around. But there always was a struggle about who was running this band.
Well, their original leader was Brian Jones. He was the best musician. It was his sound. When you listen to those early Stones records and you hear Anything Strange, it's him. It's his slide guitar, him playing the recorder, you know. And he really chose a set list and he spoke, and it was Brian Jones' band. And that was how it was in the little clubs with blues fans. But when they got bigger, people naturally started to identify, especially girls, with Mick Jagger because he was the one who was singing. He was the one you looked at. You look at the singer. And that drove Brian Jones crazy. And then the other thing that happened was you had to start writing your own music, because that's what Bob Dylan did and that's what the Beatles did.
Because they were doing covers at that point, a lot of blues stuff.
All their first songs were covers.
Yeah.
And their first hit was a cover, was Little Red Rooster. And it was they started writing their own songs. Now, their manager was this guy, Andrew Lou Goldham, who was actually younger than them. He was like 17 years old. And he said to them, you have to write your own music. And he was living with them. So one of the reasons why it's Jagger Richards is just because they were the ones around. If Jagger had been living with Brian Jones, maybe it would have been Jagger Jones. They weren't like Paul McCartney and John Lennon, who sort of you feel like no matter when they would have lived, they would have written these songs, because they were completely melodic songwriters, almost like Broadway songwriters. These guys had to learn how to write songs for the Rolling Stones, and they're really driven by the groove, and you see how they worked together, and it was sort of fascinating, because usually Keith Richards would write the riff, like the four notes, and then the phrase, and then give it to Jagger, who'd write the rest. So he'd write, you know, he wrote Satisfaction, he wrote the riff, and he wrote Can't Get No Satisfaction, which Jagger always claimed came from actually a Chuck Berry song where he sings, I can't get no satisfaction from the judge. And then he gave it to Jagger, who filled in everything else, and then bam, it became a hit. So it was pure collaboration. So if those guys aren't friends, aren't collaborating, the music ends.
Well, let's take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll get into the darker days of the two. I guess the breakup. I mean, the breakup is interpretive. But we'll talk about the Rolling Stones. The book is called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. The author is Rich Cohen. We'll talk more with Rich after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me at the big table, Rich Cohen. The new book, The Sun, the Moon, and the Rolling Stones. Talk about a great story. It's just like a tailor-made story where Rich was a Rolling Stones fan who got the greatest assignment in the world to cover the Rolling Stones for Rolling Stone magazine. This is really the story of that, and also sort of chronicles the life of the Rolling Stones. You know, one of the things I loved about the book, like we talked about a little bit earlier, you are critical in some ways. You know, going to see the Rolling Stones at the Superdome.
Right.
You know, was sort of, that was when it kind of pops up at the beginning. You sum up the Rolling Stones as I kind of know them.
Right. Well, at some point, it's like they almost became a kind of oldies act, you know? And I felt like at the beginning of their career, they were imitating people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Chuck Berry. And by the time I was seeing them in college, they were imitating themselves as they had been 15 years earlier. You know, and you sort of like, I always said, you don't really know what an oldies act is, but it's like that definition of pornography, like you know it when you see it, you know. And it just wasn't alive in the same way. And I had been into the Rolling Stones when I was a really young kid. I always said I was like the kid singing Mother's Little Helper, but I had no idea what that song meant, you know? And then later on, I kind of moved on to other music, but I always kind of had this special place for the Rolling Stones. It's like your first love, your first kind of girlfriend. And
what I really loved about it, though, is that later in that assignment, I think it was a different assignment, you got a chance to see them play in a bar. I think it was back in Toronto, right, where they actually got to
right. Well, that's what happened, which is I saw them in the Superdome, and it's like completely diffused, man. It doesn't work. And it's like you could be seeing a Bears game.
And that's how most people see the Rolling Stone these days, right?
Right, yeah. And then I saw them in this gym, and that's pretty incredible. But then just before they went out on tour, they did a little surprise gig in a little tiny bar in Toronto called the Macomba Lounge, I think, which is named after the original Chess Records. And it was, you know, like a place that held like 300-400 people, and half of them just people drinking, and suddenly the Rolling Stones are playing. And you're like, oh my God, this is the Rolling Stones. I mean, this is what the guys are talking about at the Ealing Club in England. This is what they're built for. They're a little bar band. Wow. They're a little engine. They all need to be pressed together. They need to be jammed up close. So when people tell me, oh yeah, I went to see the Rolling Stones, you know, and they weren't that great. I saw them in Soldier Field. I'm like, you didn't see the Rolling Stones. I mean, the Rolling Stones exist in a bar, and they exist at 2 a.m. when you're drunk. You know, and Keith has found the groove, and Mick has remembered who he really is. That's the Rolling Stones.
So for you, I really like when the article came out, the Rolling Stone article, when you were 25, 26 years old, you got a note from Mick Jagger's publicist. It's like, I think you got this article wrong. It says On the Road with the Rolling Stones, but it should be called I Love Keith Richards. I want to marry Keith Richards, or whatever it was. You don't hold back. You actually identify more with Keith Richards than a Mick Jagger.
Well, I do and I don't. I mean, I don't think Keith Richards, you can sort of like, there's like, if you ever saw the movie The Sure Thing, like Keith Richards is like your pal Nick, man. He's your buddy. You can throw up in his car and everything. That's like Keith Richards. You can not really know him and very quickly feel like you know him and pal around with him. Mick Jagger is mercurial. I worked with him, you know, as a co-writer, and you feel like you know him, but you never really know him. And an example is when I interviewed him. When I first interviewed him, I was taping him, and as he's talking, I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting such a scoop here. I'm getting unbelievable stuff. It's like going to change the world. No one's ever gotten this kind of stuff. And I get it transcribed, and it's nothing. There's nothing there. It's like he said a lot of words, but he said nothing. And that's his genius. Keith, I couldn't understand what he said. He was like mumbling. I was leaning in. I couldn't hear anything. That got transcribed by a really good transcriber with good headphones, and it was genius, man. Everything was gold. You know, so that was sort of the difference. But after that first story came out, that was published. And then I went back on the road with them. Now on the tour, I met them again in the course of the summer. And you immediately could tell they're in two different camps. They have nothing to do with each other. Jagger and Richards at that point weren't talking
to each
other.
This is what? This would be
96, okay. I think. 96, 98. And, you know, you don't really hang out with Mick Jagger before the show. It's just he's alone. He's in his own space. He's like, the great Pavarotti is going out to sing. He's got a voice coach. Whereas Keith Richards, he sits in what they call the guitar room with Ron Wood, and they just drink Jack Daniels, smoke cigarettes, dip into that medical bag I told you about, and play old Hank Williams tunes and joke around, you know? And in the distance, you can sort of hear Jagger going through his scales, and they're, like, laughing at him. You know, they're laughing at the scales. So it's, like, really very – it's sort of intense, but it's – right away, you sort of are in that camp.
Were you surprised by that? Were you, as a writer, that there was that much kind of animosity between the two?
Yeah, I was. If I'd done a lot of research, maybe I wouldn't have been. I realized that tension, it's very common in these kind of bands. And, I mean, this is just a primo example of it. And weirdly, out of that tension is the soap opera that makes the band so interesting. And also is a lot of the tension that's the music. And then it winds up being what a lot of the songs are even about. But you don't realize it because at some point their fame sealed them off from the world, so their material became their kind of own rock star lives.
For you, I mean, you were did a good job enough, and they didn't feel like you sabotaged them in any way, that you were able to work with Mick Jagger, and he introduced you to Marty Scorsese, and you were able to co-create the show Vinyl, which is on HBO, which is about the rise and fall of a record executive in this time. I mean, it's very Rolling Stones-like in the way that it's presented. Talk about that experience, because for you as a young writer, I mean, a little bit older when you got to do this, but, I mean, you're now writing screenplays. plays with Marty Scorsese and Mick Jagger, and they almost chose you because you didn't have experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's like, you know, one of the people I got to know later on was Hunter S. Thompson, you know, patron saint of Rolling Stone, and he had this expression, gonzo. And everyone knows the word, but not everyone knows what it means, which is explained to me by him, which is gonzo means you learn to fly by falling out of a plane, you know? And that's basically, that's rock and roll. And that's what writing about rock and roll in a way should be. And that's kind of what vinyl is. What happened is after I did those stories, Jagger and Scorsese wanted to make a movie about the rock and roll business, about a rock and roll executive who's also living kind of the rock and roll lifestyle, just like the musicians, you know? And I got hired for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is I'd gotten to know Jagger. I'd been on the road with them.
They trusted you. They knew you knew the story.
We clicked. Yep. Everything was cool. I'd written this book called Tough Jews about Jewish gangsters in Brooklyn in the 1930s. Scorsese read it and really liked it. It was kind of had the voice of Goodfellas in my head, so there's no reason why he liked it. I was copying him in a way, you know? He liked himself.
I liked that. I liked it a lot.
And I'd done a bunch of – and in working at Rolling Stone, I'd already interviewed a bunch of these old legendary music guys who started the business. So they hired me, and basically my job with them was to create the world, create the characters. And I tried to do it by going around and interviewing guys like Ahmet Erdogan, you know, Jerry Wexler, the guys who built, you know, the record business. And in the old, old days in Brooklyn, there was a big overlap between them and the gangsters because that's who financed a lot of those businesses. And that became even a much longer relationship than the stories in Rolling Stone, because I think I worked on that for 10 years with Jagger.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, 10 years of going into Mick Jagger's apartment or Marty Scorsese's place and you guys hanging out for a couple hours, throwing ideas against the wall. I mean, that's like, again, I go back to that idea of being in that gym in Toronto. Did you have an out-of-body experience with these two legends where they're counting on you to bring your expertise as a writer to the game?
Absolutely, and really with Scorsese, because, first of all, we mostly worked at his house, which is on the Upper East Side of New York, and his office, which is also on the Upper East Side, and he would like have an idea and say, oh, you should see this movie. You know, like you'd say to a friend, oh, you should see this movie. And the next day you get a call from, you know, the screener, okay, Marty's screening the movie, what time are you going to be here? And you sit in the movie theater in his house or in his office by yourself with a guy, and you have to go to the bathroom, and you kind of get up and sneak out like in a movie, and they hear the projectionist go, hey, should I shut off the movie or what? You know, but the thing with him was, like you said, which is, I'd never written a screenplay before. I was a journalist. And he said, good, because I'm not really going to teach you how to write a movie because most movies suck. I'm going to teach you how to write a Marty Scorsese movie. And that's really what he spent a lot of time doing. And it was, you know, just on a personal level, it was an incredible experience for me. And it was like you're so focused on doing a good job.
I was going to say that, the insecurities of being around such legends in both music and movies and saying, am I doing a good job?
Right.
Is this what you want?
But Scorsese especially, because he's so into making you feel like, oh my God, that's the funniest thing in the world. You know, you realize that there's a lot of people that are really creative and smart like that. They're so good at making you feel good about yourself in some way that it actually gets the best out of you. You feel kind of like, hey man, I'm on an incredible role here. You know, so that was like several years of that. And you know, it was awesome. And even Jagger, like Jagger had one great note about the screenplay that became Vinyl, because he said, you know, all this stuff is great, but the thing you are missing, maybe you should remember, is that it was funny. You know, everybody writes about those days like it was high drama and it was Altamont and it was the Hell's Angels. And what everyone doesn't realize is it was funny, man. We were kids and we were having a really fun time. And all this stuff was a joke and we were laughing all the time. And that's missing from all of this. And then I realized, God, this movie's kind of a comedy.
That's wonderful. Rich Cohen, the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Also the co-creator of Vinyl on HBO, which just wrapped up its first season. Let's take a last break here. We'll come back and wrap up our conversation with Rich here at the Big Table. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Rich Cohen's at Big Table tonight, the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, talking about his unbelievable, surreal experience of being a young journalist for Rolling Stone magazine and getting to cover the Rolling Stones, and the history of this. It's surreal. it's surreal for you to be a fan of this band and be able to do this, to then take it to the next step and write a book about it, and be involved with Mick Jagger on vinyl. I mean, what does that mean to you? I mean, as not just a writer, but as a fan of this band.
Well, it's almost like when I started going back and getting into this and reading other books, I'm like, why did I never write about this before? I mean, and then I realized partly because the relationship didn't end and the experience continued. And it's like, I'm sort of like a big believer, like you have to put the glass down and let all the dirt settle at the bottom before you can actually see what the water looks like. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the end of a chapter of my life in a way, because this, I feel like I stepped back and I could see the entire thing. And the part of my life that was really all about chasing these bands, which went from like age 10 or 11 until I was like 40 years old. And that was really the center of that was the Rolling Stones. So it's, you know, a little melancholy in a way, you know, because when you, after, the weird thing about writing about something is kind of you write about it and then you're kind of out of it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's good, and but it's there's a slight melancholy to it, I'd say.
You know, I thought about this when I was reading this book, that, you know, Monsters was the same way. Some of the stuff we talked to you about, the New York Times piece about going around the lake we talked about last summer, even the Cubs stuff that you wrote about, you know, it's how it relates to you as a child. It's the way that you write. You seem to find these relatable things that we know, these big ticket things, whether it be the Cubs or the Rolling Stones, and you're able to write about it through the lens of growing up with it. You know, is that intentional for you in these pieces? I mean, it seems to be sort of your hallmark.
I think, like, when you're a kid, you have the right idea, and you know what you like. And when you get older, you don't know what you like, and you have to try to figure out what you like, and you end up doing stuff you don't really like. I don't know how many times I'm doing stuff, and I'm like, you know, I don't even like this. I'm in the middle of it. But when you're a kid, that doesn't happen. You know what you like, and it's like the only time you're ever really at home is when you're a kid. And the rest of your life, you're kind of in exile from being a kid. That's how I feel like. So the stuff that interested me when I was 10, 12, 15, that's the real stuff, man. That's like the really good, pure, deep stuff. And that's the kind of stuff I want to write about.
Is that why we all go watch the Rolling Stones? Is that why we all pay top dollar to go see the Soldier Field? Because it reminds us of a different place or something that was more, that was pure in our life?
Yeah, and think about it. Everybody wants the music that it was on the radio when they were 15, okay? And most bands have one song like that, and you go back, and that's the band of your youth. The Rolling Stones have had so many different peaks that they were on the radio when basically everybody was 15 at some point. So they have this massive audience because they kept reinventing themselves, you know, as a pop band, as a psychedelic band, as kind of almost a punk band, as a disco band. And they had all these different peaks, so there's so many different generations' childhood. And I always say, like, most bands live and die once. The Stones have lived and died so many times that they might as well be immortal.
Is there, I mean, it's hard to say, and this is maybe a really cliche question, but will we ever see the Rolling Stones again? As I mean, because like you said, I mean, they're able to reinvent themselves every 5 years, which, you know, as I said, that's how bands have to, that's how they have to be if they're going to be successful in pop music.
Right, and they had this manager, Angelou Goldham, who said, you have to reinvent yourself every 5 years because that's how long it takes a kid to go from basically the middle of high school till now he's working, and there's a new crop of kids, and they want their own music, so you have to become a new band for that new group of kids. And the key ingredient of the Rolling Stones and the reason why they've lasted so long more than anything else is Mick Jagger. And everybody, you know, kind of busts on him, people like Keith and this, that, and the other. But Jagger's been so determined, level-headed, driven them on, that they would have broken up. They did break up, really, in the late 70s, early 80s. And they would have broken up in the 60s, and they would have broken up in the 70s, and they would have stopped playing together just like every other, just like the Beatles. But they didn't, because there's something unbelievably driven and about Jagger. And he's kept them going and made them, you know, to the fact that they're just playing in Cuba. They're the first rock band to go and play in Havana.
And again, they're a bunch of firsts. They're the first with this band. Well, it's a great book, tremendous read, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, not just about author Rich Cohen's experience with them, but also history. I mean, you talked to so many people, and we didn't even get into so many parts. The one part I really wanted to get into, maybe we could just sum it up quick, is that, you know, there are a lot of people that surround that band, from, you know, girlfriends to common law to wives to band members to equipment managers, and it doesn't always turn out well for people that are involved in the Rolling Stones.
No, I mean, one thing that is that they have a huge talent for is finding the most talented people of their time and working with them. And they have the way that you reinvent themselves is they get new people.
Yeah.
And the people that are so important to them are suddenly off the train. And when you're in that circle, especially back in the 60s, it must have been unbelievable. You're at sort of this hot center of the world, you know, and you get all this feeling of self-worth that's borrowed. It's borrowed from Jagger and Richards. And then suddenly you're out and it's like over.
Yeah.
And those people all wrote books because that was the event of their lives. And it's sort of like the Rolling Stones are just, I think Steel Wheels was a great title of a record for them because they're like a train. And once you're off, it's like you fall off the train, instantly the train's 50, you know, miles away from you, just like that.
So much to learn from this band and the book, The Sun, the Moon, and the Rolling Stones. Rich Cohen, thanks for being my guest tonight. I appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Justin.
Rich Cohen's going to be at Mark Baser's show tomorrow, the interview show at The Hideout, 6:30 start. The Hideout up on 1354 West Wabanzi, if you want to check out. He'll be interviewed by Mark. And I think it's for I believe it's for WTTW, like for be an episode later time. Rob, are you a fan of the Rolling Stones?
I saw them at the Bell Center in Montreal in 2006, maybe.
How did you like the show?
I loved it, but what was funny is, you know, you go from everybody back in the day holding up their cigarette lighters to holding up the cell phones.
Right.
So that was fun. No, you know, I'll tell you what. Mick Jagger, however old he is now, was unbelievable. And they played for 2.5 hours. They from start to finish, 2.5 hours, no encore, but you certainly got your money's worth.
Well, I will say that last night we kind of did the what did we learn kind of segment at the end of the show. What I learned from that conversation is that Rich nailed it. They have reinvented themselves so many times in their career that they mean something to so many different 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that's why when they play Soldier Field, or that's why they've existed so long. That's why they'll play this summer or whenever they play again, and it'll be sold out because there's so many different generations that see them as the band of their childhood.
That's my tremendous. 16-year-old twins, my 6-year-old, my 4-year-old, they all have a favorite Rolling Stones song. So when it comes on the radio, I've got to turn it up.
That's great.
That's fun.
Ah, so good.